President Biden puts the brakes on a U.S. steel deal.
But it can't be harvesting our facilities and letting them slowly but surely over a period of time deteriorate so that they can then bring product in from their other facilities around the world and have access to our market.
The U.S. Surgeon General says alcohol is a leading cause of cancer.
The WHO says that there's no good level of alcohol. There is no benefit of alcohol. And there are multiple organs that are affected by alcohol in a negative way.
Join us now on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
This isn't about Japan. This is about U.S. steelmaking and keeping one of the largest steel producers in the United States, an American-owned company. It is not about the extraordinary close relationship and the alliance that we have with Japan. And the president has said so and made that clear.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Friday followed through on his pledge to block Nippon Steel's $14.9 billion bid to purchase U.S. Steel, citing concerns the deal could hurt national security. We get more on this now from Reuters correspondent Sierra Lee.
The move, long expected, cuts off a critical lifeline of capital for the beleaguered American business. U.S. Steel has said it would have to idle key mills without the nearly $3 billion in promised investment from the Japanese firm. The proposed tie-up faced high-level opposition from the powerful United Steelworkers Union, as well as politicians. Both Biden and his incoming successor, Donald Trump, have taken aim at it as they sought to woo union voters in the swing state of Pennsylvania, where U.S. Steel is headquartered. Trump and Biden both asserted the company should remain American-owned. U.S. Steel has previously said the deal's failure would put at risk thousands of jobs, and it might be forced to close some steel mills, an assertion the USW union called baseless threats and intimidation. Nippon paid a hefty premium to clinch the purchase of the number two U.S. steel producer in an auction in 2023, but the bid prompted a review of the deal by the Committee on Foreign Investment, which vets international acquisitions for national security risks. The committee passed the final decision to Biden. Japan is a key U.S. ally in the Indo-Pacific, where China's economic and military rise has raised concerns in Washington, along with threats from North Korea. Japan is also the top investor in the United States.
Reuters correspondent Sierra Lee.
Let's try to understand this very complicated deal. Joining us now to help us with that is Scott Lang, an assistant professor at the School of Management, University at Buffalo.
Thank you so much for being able to take the time to join us to talk about this.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Tell us what happened. So Nippon Steel wants to buy U.S. Steel. What happened?
Well, it seems that the Biden administration finally said no more to the deal as of today, I believe. Nippon Steel offered quite a generous price to acquire U.S. Steel, well over the current stock trading price. I believe U.S. Steel is trading at about $30 per share, and Nippon Steel offered about $54, I believe, per share, so a significant premium over market price. But the Biden administration had concerns about national security issues and won't allow the acquisition to move forward, unfortunately.
So what is the main problem that the president sees? It's supposedly there are national security concerns, but what would they be?
That's a great question. And so when you guys reached out to me for this interview, I tried to do a lot of digging. I've been following this acquisition for a while now, and there's been this back and forth and this nebulous national security concern. And there was never any real substance to these claims that we were hearing from various administration officials. And so I suppose the logic, and I'm speculating slightly here because they haven't outright said the exact justification, is the fear of a foreign entity owning a major manufacturing component of the U.S. economy, right? And so if U.S. Steel is the current steel maker, there is some competition. If Nippon comes in and acquires them, do we really want a foreign nation, a foreign entity, having control over such an important resource such as steel in our country? Now, the concern that kind of should be mitigated a little bit with that is, all right, that could be a concern all else equal, right? If, you know, U.S. Steel was able to still produce at this rate, even without Nippon Steel acquiring it, all right, sure. If wartime occurred, we would want to be able to easily leverage all of those steel manufacturing processes, repurpose them in an emergency situation. But the problem with objecting to the merger is, well, all right, U.S. Steel was kind of on a downward trajectory. It's going to probably not be really fiscally able to survive. So we have this opportunity for Nippon Steel to come in and acquire it, reinvest, keep the jobs, keep the plants alive, keep the steel being made, in fact, invest in it, get the processes and infrastructure more modern. Without that deal going through, we're going to see job loss. We're going to see factories slowly struggle to produce, slowly struggle to make revenues, slowly lose their ability to produce that steel. So even if there was a wartime situation or an emergency, the very act of blocking this suggests that U.S. Steel is not even going to be around to produce those goods that we so need, as the Biden administration is sort of claiming and proposing. So then becomes, which is the worst of two evils? Do you allow U.S. Steel to fail, or do you allow it to stick around under foreign ownership? Or maybe there's another situation where I think the Biden administration was hoping, and I think it's natural in the public eye, when you hear U.S. Steel, you think American Steel. When you hear Nippon Steel, Japan, it's almost psychological that the average consumer or the average American wants U.S. Steel to be made by a U.S. company, a domestically owned business. And so what you run the risk of then is there was a second offer for U.S. Steel, and that was from Cleveland-Cliffs, a competing steel company that is domestic. They offered about, I think, $40 per share, maybe high 30s per share. And Nippon Steel obviously offered a significant higher premium. For U.S. Steel, they have a fiduciary obligation to go where the higher bid is. But okay, Biden administration wants it to be domestically owned. If Cleveland-Cliffs goes through, acquires it for a significantly cheaper rate than Nippon was willing to pay, well, the question becomes, what's worse? Do you want a monopoly on U.S. Steel, which is what's going to occur if Cleveland-Cliffs does go through with their offer, and they have no real incentive to stick to their original offer now that Nippon has been rejected? They're probably going to undercut their original offer a little bit. Or do you rather the competition, which in my economics courses, you know, I always teach competition, competition, competition. Competition is good. It keeps prices low. It's good for the consumer. And even though it's a Japanese company, there is going to be competition then between Cleveland-Cliffs, Nucor, the already in place U.S. Steel manufacturing companies. It's just you're competing against one foreign entity who, keep in mind, is an ally and a trading partner.
Well, there is also, let's unpack a little bit of that. I know the two American companies don't like each other. There's bad blood between them. That's definitely one problem in the Cleveland deal. Number two, there are legitimate supply chain concerns, because we're just coming out of the pandemic. Couldn't make cars in Detroit because we couldn't get chips that weren't made here anymore. So right. One of the arguments that I heard was Nippon Steel says over a course of time, we're going to slow the production at U.S. Steel because the world market is down. They ramp down production there. Something disrupts the supply chain, like a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And then you can't get the steel in the United States for whatever you need it for.
I think that's a fair argument. I would counter argue that we saw during the pandemic, I can't recall if it was President Trump or President Biden or maybe possibly both of them. I believe they enacted one of the wartime clauses that they have the presidential power to enact. And they forced a lot of, I know it's not automobile makers, but they forced a lot of factories in the United States to produce PPE equipment, right? The face masks, a lot of the sanitizer, the stuff that the hospitals needed. I would think that if there was a situation where the supply chain had a sudden shock that was exogenous, like a pandemic, that whoever is in charge of whatever administration would have the ability to effectively enact that wartime clause and say, hey, we need steel ramped up now. It's not as if Nippon Steel has moved all of the workers and all of the infrastructure and the factories to Japan. They're still in America. I think it would be not unrealistic to assume that they could, in a dire, dire situation, kind of nationalize it temporarily, take control of the factories and produce the steel if there was a shock to that magnitude. I think that would be my counter argument. But the supply chain is an interesting concern and part of why U.S. Steel is struggling, especially with, you know, international competition. I was reading about how, you know, China is supplying really low quality steel and kind of artificially lowering the price point, which is further causing the strain at U.S. Steel because they can't compete at that low price point given the quality issues, which maybe Nippon Steel could figure out a solution to. But it seems that U.S. Steel is kind of fallen behind and isn't able to compete at the moment. But I'm not sure if I answered your question.
I'm wondering, is there a political component to this decision by President Biden? Although, he's almost out of office, so he doesn't have, any stake in his political future with this. But do you think that there was something political in the decision?
I mean, I would speculate he has no stake for his political future, but he has stake for his political legacy. And so President Biden, all throughout his career as a senator, as a vice president, as a president, he's been incredibly pro-union, pro-labor rights. He does not want his legacy tarnished at the home stretch of his presidency, even with him resigning from office, to be anti-union in any way. He wants to support what the Steelworkers Union is doing. They do not want Nippon Steel to go through, and I think President Biden wants to stand by with one of these final stances that reflects his whole career.
And he's, you're not wrong. You mentioned it earlier. There is that iconic U.S. Steel brand. I mean, I immediately thought, I always think of the movie The Godfather, where, you know, they're in Cuba and he says, Michael, we're bigger than U.S. Steel, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think there is something psychological about that inherently. And you're right. It is U.S. Steel. To say that it's going to become owned by Japan, it's going to be Nippon Steel, it's no longer going to be, you know, this company that reflects American values. But unfortunately, you know, if it's a company that needs saving, what's the lesser of two evils? Do we let this American standard, this American brand completely fall apart and vanish potentially, go bankrupt, have its pieces scrapped by other companies? Or do we allow an ally to save it, keep the legacy going? Who's to say that Nippon will keep it for decades? You know, they might divest it again at some point. And after they've, you know, strengthened the infrastructure, made the improvements, made it a more appealing purchase for another American company, we could keep the name alive versus letting it, you know, face an early demise if it's facing such dire straits.
Do they have any recourse?
Nippon?
Yeah.
Well, they've said that they're going to try and sue. Whether or not they'll be able to, how far they'll get is going to be remain to be seen. I also know President Trump is inbound. I was reading how his, I believe, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is a consultant for Nippon Steel. So I'm sure there's a lot of lobbying going on behind the scenes. I think there's a bit of a disconnect between the union leadership and the union workers. And ultimately, this kind of ties back to your earlier question of, you know, with President Biden and his political stake in the game. I mean, both presidents won their presidencies through the swing state of Pennsylvania. And these steelworkers are, I think, 18,000 voters that determine the presidency currently. And I think both Biden and Trump have reason to want to make those workers happy. The question becomes, again, do we let potentially, you know, we say this is an American company, American brand, we're going to keep it American. But what if there's no buyers after Nippon? What if Cleveland gives a really bad offer? Do we really want to risk this company going completely under, losing 18,000 good union jobs? Nippon did promise they were going to keep the union jobs. So I don't know if – I think they're going to probably pursue recourse. I would imagine they're going to kind of work behind the scenes, though, and see if there's some way to still get across the finish line with the new administration coming in soon. But that's all speculation.
And he has said publicly that he, too, is opposed to the sale. Said it during the campaign. Scott, thanks so much for the time, the insight, the
Yes, thank you so much for interviewing me. Yeah, love it.
That was Scott Lang, an assistant professor at the School of Management, University at Buffalo.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Scott Walterman, along with Lori London. Alcohol is a leading cause of cancer, a risk that should be clearly labeled on drinks. Well, that's what the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says. He made the proposal on Friday as research and evidence mounts about the bad effects that alcohol has on human health. About 20,000 people die every year in the United States from alcohol-related cancer cases, according to his advisory.
Bottles of beer, wine, and liquor already carry warning labels about the risk of birth defects when a pregnant woman consumes alcohol. But people at a pub in New York City asked about it had mixed reactions to the proposed new label.
I don't think it would make any difference. If people want to drink, they will drink regardless of any warnings. It's like with the smoking. I'm a smoker myself, and the warnings haven't put me off at all.
I'm a, you know, not a heavy drinker at all. Like, I just probably take a drink once a month. So for me, you know, it doesn't really affect me as much. But, you know, for others, it's just like cigarettes, right? You have the labels and the warning labels there. So there must have been some research that indicates that there might be some sort of risk.
Well, I think even though it might not help, it might make people stop and, you know, take a second thought about it. So in that respect, it may help a little bit.
Joining us now to help us understand the link between cancer and alcohol is Elizabeth Kovacs, director of the Alcohol Research Program at the University of Colorado on Schutz Medical Campus.
How does alcohol create problems that can lead to cancer?
WHO says that there's no good level of alcohol. There is no benefit of alcohol. And there are multiple organs that are affected by alcohol in a negative way, including the oral cavity and throat, the liver, as you mentioned, the larynx, the colorectal region of the large intestine, as well as in females, breast cancer. They all have increased risk of cancer from consuming alcohol.
How does it create conditions for cancer to grow?
So alcohol increases oxidative stress. And if you have excess oxidative stress and inflammation, that can alter DNA and proteins as well as the cell itself. Acetaldehyde is one of the byproducts or degradation products of alcohol, and that can damage DNA directly. Large amounts of alcohol can also alter levels of sex hormones like estrogen, which can play a role in breast cancers, for example.
It increases the estrogen?
It increases the estrogen in under certain conditions at certain ages. But in terms of overall cancer risk, lay people think that the predominant driver of breast cancer is family history. And in reality, only about 30% of women with breast cancer have a family history of breast cancer, which is why mammograms are offered to the whole population. Lifestyle issues and lifestyle risk factors like weight, diet, exercise, and alcohol consumption are also important and need to be addressed.
I remember in the last couple of years, there was also a study that said dairy products like cheese raise the risk of breast cancer. How much of what we consume or come in contact with can lead to cancer or other similar ailments?
I think we need to be conscious of what we put in our bodies on all levels, that there are direct effects of some of the foods we eat that may have carcinogens in them or carcinogenic actions, but there are also more subtle changes that may be affected that could increase the risk of cancers, such as, you know, about genetics. There's also epigenetics, which involves DNA modification, and some of these things we ingest, including alcohol, can cause epigenetic changes to genes, which may promote cancers.
What about the health effects of light to moderate drinking? You know, we have for a long time heard that at least one thing, red wine, supposedly had health benefits. Is that the case? And from light to moderate, and also, is there any kind of alcohol that could have health benefits, such as red wine?
That's not what people think anymore. That was trendy for a while, but the concept of less alcohol is better than more is certainly one of the things, but no alcohol is better than some. The National Institutes of Health and the CDC here in the U.S. have stated that it would be okay for men to drink 2 drinks a day, meaning 14 drinks a week, and for women, 7 drinks a week, 1 drink a day. But now people are suggesting that less than 3 drinks a week is probably a better level of alcohol consumption to maintain health.
Do you have any idea of the rates of deaths, or specifically cancer or otherwise?
It's a good question, because when I saw the article, it seemed like it was really small numbers, all things considered. 100,000 and 20,000 deaths a year?
Those numbers are the current data. Across the globe, the numbers are higher. There are some countries in which alcohol is consumed at a higher rate than in the U.S. But to me, if there are things that we can easily do or easily cut out of our diets that would decrease our risks of cancer, why wouldn't we do it? And there have been the old labels that have been around for 30 plus years saying that alcohol could cause problems for pregnant women, and a few other, I can't remember what else is on there. But, you know, why not have something that says cancer could be caused by alcohol?
Are the number of drinking deaths on the rise in the U.S.?
They actually have been growing astronomically since the COVID lockdown period. And many situations where there's a lot of stress after 9/11, alcohol was increased in alcohol sales in New York City after that year and stayed up to at higher levels, never returned to the baseline levels from pre-9/11. So all kinds of stressful things make people want to drink. The patients in our intensive care unit for respiratory failure had much higher levels of alcohol than we'd had prior to the COVID outbreak in that same patient population. So whether the people who have respiratory failure had higher levels of alcohol or whether the higher levels of alcohol caused them to have respiratory failure is unclear.
Some things are outlawed, and yet this is something that's illegal, and it's very sort of embedded in a lot of cultures.
But if you think about things that were considered less harmful years ago, like cigarettes, we discovered that they're harmful, and now we know they're harmful. We know alcohol is harmful, and while it is legal just as cigarettes are legal, there are groups of people who are choosing to abstain from both of those.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
That was Elizabeth Kovacs, director of the Alcohol Research Program at the University of Colorado's Anschutz Medical Campus.
Guidelines vary a lot from country to country, but the overall trend is toward drinking less. The UK, France, Denmark, Holland, and Australia recently reviewed new evidence and lowered their alcohol consumption recommendations. And Ireland will require cancer warning labels on alcohol starting in 2026.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for spending this time with us.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue, Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com.
And join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, in Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London.